Hello, everybody. Here we go. Glad to have you all on board. This is Cal Banyan broadcasting on the internet. Welcome to our virtual classroom. It's wonderful to think about how I can just sit here in my office at the Banyan Hypnosis Center and be able to bring you these wonderful interviews. So thank you for joining us this evening. I suspect more people will be joining us as the hour moves on. After our seminar here with Sean Brookhouse, I hope you'll log back in at 7 o'clock Central Time, about an hour and a half from now, and be here for Debbie Livingston's seminar on spiritual hypnotherapy. Note that after these interviews have been recorded, they will be posted on our website at www.banyanhypnosismall.com. So you can review this seminar anytime you want, and also tell your friends who are not able to make it to this live presentation. All right, we're about to head into our interview program. I'd like to ask everyone to hold off on asking questions until our speaker asks for questions. So here we go, the official beginning. Meet the Pros audio seminar program. This program is sponsored by the Banyan Hypnosis Mall, the place with the good stuff that hypnotists want. Books, tapes, CDs, DVDs, articles, scripts, and live courses. It's our intention to bring you top professionals in the field of hypnosis who can give you the inside scoop on hypnosis, the hypnosis business, our profession, as well as related topics such as NLP, and self-help. So enjoy the program. Let me introduce Sean Brookhouse, who will be talking to us today about Ericksonian hypnosis. Dr. Sean Brookhouse is a UKCP registered psychotherapist, a certified professional coach, a board certified hypnotherapist, educator, and author. He's known by many as the therapist therapist. He is a master trainer of NLP and a certified hypnotherapy instructor. His skills as an instructor and trainer make him very much in demand internationally at conferences and workshops. Before I turn this over to Sean, I want to tell you a little bit about some research I did on the internet about Sean. He has got so many awards and recognitions going back over the years. I see, at least 10, 11, 12 years' worth of recognition I was able to find right away. Let me just mention a couple here. Pioneer Award for the American Council of Hypnotist Examiners. The CELA Award for the International Hypnosis Hall of Fame. Hypnosis Journalism Award for the National Guild of Hypnotists. The President's Award from the National Guild of Hypnotists, their second highest honor. The Order of Braid for the National Guild of Hypnotists for lifetime service to the profession. International Visionary Award, that's a very special award from the National Guild of Hypnotists. He is the very first recipient of that award. I think Sean has won so many awards that the organizations are starting to create them so that they can continue to recognize really his contribution to the profession. Let me give you a couple more. The Heartland Memorial Award for the National Council for Hypnotherapy for services, hypnotherapy professionals worldwide, first recipient. And then the Rexford L. North Memorial Trophy for lifetime achievement, the National Guild of Hypnotists, their highest honor given in 2004. So with all that, I'm sure you're all applauding in the background. Let me turn this seminar over to Sean Brookhouse, who's going to talk about the history of Ericksonian hypnosis and then give you some tools that you can walk away from this course with that you can use right away. Sean, before you get started, if you could maybe just give a little bit of a history of how you got interested in hypnosis and how you came to be who you are today, and then just feel free to go right into your seminar. Okay, Sean, please, welcome aboard.
Well, Cal, thank you very much for that introduction. So does the group have any questions? No, I'm only kidding. I'm better prepared for this than that. A little bit about my coming into hypnosis, I think, would be a useful thing to start. I started as a professional hypnotist in 1989. I was an undergraduate, and I needed the money, basically. And I really didn't want to do proper work, or at least at the time I didn't think I wanted to do proper work. And I found the whole hypnosis experience interesting. What I eventually did is I went on to graduate school and went on, became a psychotherapist as well. But I've been in... My sole income has come from hypnosis since 1989 January. I think on a piece of paper, I think it's January 15th, 1989. This has been my sole gig, as it were. So I've been involved in the field for a fair old amount of time, but I'm still young and beautiful, which is kind of helpful. Let's go into Erikson. Erikson is an interesting character in that there are an awful lot of folk who think they understand what Erikson was all about. I don't include myself in that lot. I'm feeling my way along and picking and choosing what I find of the Ericksonian model that sort of works best for me. But let me give you a brief breakdown of Erikson in history, as it were. Erikson was born in 1901. I believe it was 1901. He was born into a poor family, one of several children. But Erikson, as he was growing up, certainly showed a certain academic gift, if you will. He was the first person in his family to go to university. But before going to university, in his junior or senior year of high school, he developed a very severe strand of polio. With this polio, he was... basically crippled. The doctor at the time had said that Erikson wouldn't survive the night. And as the stories go with Erikson, he said that the doctor should never have told that to his mother because it upset her. So he managed to have the dresser pushed so that the window would face the mirror so that he could lie in bed and look at the mirror and look outside. And in the end, excuse me, when he saw the sunrise that next day, he slipped into a coma, basically to prove the point that he would indeed survive the night. Now, Erikson was completely paralyzed from the polio incident and had to learn how to rewalk by watching his little sister rewalk. Now, as a behaviorist, I find that sort of thing fascinating. When we learn how to walk originally, we have nothing to base it against, so it's kind of a reasonably easy process. However, when we have already done something and we needed to relearn how to do it, I imagine it must have been extremely difficult for Erikson actually to relearn a basic skill that you'd never had to think about in the first place. Erikson went on to university and qualified as both a psychologist as well as a physician. He practiced medicine with the United States Army. He came into the contact of a man called Clark Hull. Now, Clark Hull was a Yale instructor who was very big in hypnosis at this time. This was in the early 1920s, stroke mid-1920s. And Hull was an interesting character. His book, by the way, has only just been reproduced. The Crown House Publishing in the UK have republished his book, Hypnosis and Suggestibility. It's a worthwhile read, if for no other reason, as a historical piece. But what's also fascinating is, and it's sort of the tenet, I think, of the way we practice hypnosis, Hull said that anything that implies trance causes trance. Now, the good thing about that is it means that we can pretty well do anything, tell a client that this is what is going to induce trance, and pretty well our clients will go along with it. Now, Erikson took this to heart, and he began to work when the war came along with the Department of Defense, as it is in our country, but I believe you call it the, I don't know quite sure what you call it, actually, but nonetheless. At that time, he met a chap called Gregory Bateson, who will figure prominently when NLP comes along some 30-odd years later. Erikson, unfortunately, was a medical oddity in the fact that he not only had one strand of polio, There are three potential strands of polio a person can contract. As a general rule, you only contract one if you ever contract any. Erickson, in his mid-40s, managed to contract a second strand of polio, which pretty well confined him to, at first, a cane and then a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Now, I mention this for a reason. Erickson's views, political views, with regard to the practice of hypnotism was what I would consider sort of considerably right-wing. In other words, physicians, dentists, doctors of any ilk or description would be allowed to practice. That would include social workers and mental health counselors would be allowed to practice hypnotism. However, anyone who did not have that kind of educational background, in Erickson's view, should not ever practice hypnosis. Now, there are two interesting factors to this. I believe that Erickson's views as time went on were skewed by the fact that he was in pain an awful lot of the time. But what's interesting is what has kept Erickson alive as far as a course of study is concerned is the lay hypnotist, whatever one wants to call non-medically trained hypnotherapists. I would prefer to call them professional hypnotists or certified hypnotists, whatever word you want to use for it. But it is their interest that kept Erickson alive throughout the years with regards to purchasing his books and his collections, which I think is kind of a delicious irony that in the great scheme of things, he would have chosen no one to have that information, but it was indeed the people who he had the biggest problem with actually kept his study going. Now, Ericksonian hypnosis is not, it's not an ology. It's not a study in and of itself. Erickson, like most psychiatrists of the time, went through his initial medical training and then went through a period of psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis at the time, and even still to this day, being the primary and preferred mode of psychotherapeutic intervention within psychiatry. Now, he did his analysis. He found that that was okay, but it didn't provide all the answers. He then did a spell with Carl Rogers and studied person-centered dynamics with him. And he spent a few years working with Rogers and, again, determined that there was some good stuff there, but it didn't answer all the questions. Eventually, Erickson threw out being a schoolist. And I would suggest to all of us that being a schoolist is not particularly healthy. At the end of the day, analysis is great, and it works sometimes. Regression is great. It works great sometimes. Direct suggestion is great, and it works sometimes. Behavioral therapy is great, and it works sometimes. As hypnotherapists, the one thing we could learn from Erickson is the fact of taking all of this stuff and creating it into one single mode of therapy. We could call it Banyanian theory, or Kynian theory, or Mottonian therapy, or whatever you want to call it, whatever works for you. Bringing that together is sort of a tenet of the way Erickson did his work. Now, there are in excess of 200 to 250 books written by, about, or relating to Erickson in some way, shape, or form. Most of these books are not great. And an awful lot of the good books are out of print. I recommend that if you want to get a good taster into Ericksonian work, you read Uncommon Therapy by Jay Haley. Jay Haley, in case you don't know, was not a hypnotherapist. Jay Haley was the father of family systems therapy. So it was Haley who introduced Ericksonian methods, if you will, to mainstream psychotherapy, psychiatry, etc., which, you know, was a great feat and a great usefulness for all of us who found Erickson's work to be particularly useful. Erickson had three stages of his professional practice. First was as the practitioner, which was from pretty well the time he qualified in medicine to the time where polio afflicted him again in the sort of 1950s. After which, he became a prolific article writer. So I would say that this was Erickson's research phase, sort of from the mid-50s, early 60s, up through until the early 70s. Then Erickson was a teacher, and Erickson taught from the 70s up until his death in 19, 1980. Now, it's important to bear in mind that Erickson was not a great teacher. Erickson's courses really were about question, metaphor, demonstration, question, metaphor, demonstration. Now, there were no notes. What Erickson would do is he would ask you to put your name, your marital status, your credential, and your license on a piece of paper. And basically, you just started taking notes from what the great man said. Now, the difficulty with something like this, and what I believe would not be a problem nowadays, that there are proper trainings in hypnosis, in that there are manuals and there are guides and there are things that we can revert back to. An awful lot of the Ericksonian principle and the Ericksonian message is hearsay. Interpretations by those who followed him, and it should be noted that an awful lot of the folk who followed Erickson originally, at the time they came into contact with Erickson, were simply young graduate students who, in my personal opinion, were highly impressionable by Erickson's actual work. So, with the exception of people like Ernest Rossi and Jay Haley, who obviously came into Ericksonian work through other channels, as I say, Haley was family systems therapy, Ernest Rossi was a Jungian analyst and the editor of the Jungian Journal before he eventually came into contact with Erickson. The vast majority of Ericksonians who you will have heard of started off life as graduate students who studied with Erickson either as part of or during their studies. So if we take a young impressionable practitioner and put them into the company of greatness, it is often difficult to see the flaws that are actually within the model. Now, an awful lot of Ericksonian therapy is hearsay. If you ever read My Voice Will Go With You by Sidney Rosen, there are a collection of stories of things that Erickson allegedly had done in order to affect therapeutic change. Things like a woman who had an obsession about the fact that her feet were too big. Erickson went to go pay a house call to her mother and deliberately trod on this woman's feet and said to her, "If your feet were a bit bigger, I would have been able to see them and I would not have trod on your feet," which apparently led to a metamorphical change. I offer you the notion of taking a lot of the Ericksonian stories as good teaching tools, but not necessarily reality with regard to therapy. So, a lot of the teaching stories and a lot of the myths and mystique around Erickson, I personally don't follow. I do follow the sort of the fundamental tenets of what I believe made Ericksonian hypnosis work particularly well. I've been rabbiting now for a few minutes, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to take myself off talk, and if anyone has any questions to start with, we'll go on, but then we'll move on from there.
Sean, I want you to know that you're coming through clear. You've got a great internet connection, and reading you very well. If there's anyone in the room right now that would like to ask Sean a question, just look at the bottom left-hand corner of your screen, and you'll see a Talk Now button. And you just click on that and hold it down while you speak, and it's kind of like a walkie-talkie, and then release it when you're done, and then Sean can reply.
It's Bruce Richardson from Australia. I don't have a question, but what's coming through to me is that perhaps now I'm understanding a little bit why the medical profession in particular have so much of a problem with what we term the lay hypnotist. It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Well, good day, Bruce. I'm not quite sure what time it is there, but thanks very much for coming in. I think you're probably a little later in the day than I am. You're absolutely right when it comes to the medical profession. This is an old standing issue, which is, as we're amongst friends, I will say this clearly, it is an obscene hypocrisy that the American Society and the Ericksonian Foundation both say under no circumstances must you ever train a layperson in these techniques. yet some of the biggest Ericksonian names will fly all over the world, Australia, Europe, etc., and teach anybody, but won't teach in the States. So they feel like they don't want to tell anybody in the States, but if you're an American who wants to learn from, say, Michael Yapko, get on a plane and fly to Ireland. He teaches there every year, and it won't make any difference the fact that you're not a medical practitioner or a psychological practitioner, because it's all comers when it's over in Europe, which I think is very sad in the great scheme of things, because ultimately this stuff should be utilized by everybody. Erickson's methodology was not something that should be secretive in any way. This is where we have a problem. It's problematic that we make hypnosis out to be something that it isn't. And the medical fraternity, for all the best will in the world at times, has been the greatest proponents of the idea of some sort of mystique. When you say you mustn't learn something, all of a sudden the one thing you want to do is you want to learn it. So it's something to bear in mind. I'll rattle on for a little while longer on the first tenet, or one of the most important tenets, I think, within Ericksonian work, and that's utilization. In traditional psychotherapy, people are taught to challenge the beliefs of the client. And by challenging the beliefs of the client, you will affect some form of therapeutic change if it's done correctly. Now, this is not to say that we accept everything that a client comes in with when we do Ericksonian work. That's not the case at all. But what is the point of challenging somebody's belief system, which is obviously something that they are holding on to for a particular reason? Why not use it? Why not actually use what the client comes in with in the first place in order to affect the change work that we need to do? I'll give you a common case in point. There are loads of people who end up having clients come in, I'm sure you've noticed this, who say, well, I wasn't hypnotized. Didn't happen for me. Felt relaxed, but it was really, really nice. And the first thing that you normally will do in this circumstance is attempt to tell them, well, okay, no, you were hypnotized. And that is what it feels like. And please don't say I've done anything wrong, because I haven't. It's good. It's right. It's how it should have been. What I would suggest is to say, well, that's right. You weren't hypnotized at this moment in time because you didn't understand what the hypnotic process was. Now, if you know what you need to ask me, let me answer your question so that you will understand what the process is like, and perhaps you may well change your mind as to what you've experienced here today. Now, what that's basically doing is saying, I'm not going to argue with you. Because in the great scheme of things, there's not a great deal of point to it. You won't win. And you're not honoring your client by arguing with them. Taking everything that the client comes in with, all of their negativity, their fears, their anxieties, all of the things that make them who they are, if we are to use that to assist our clients in change, rather than telling them that they're... I'll give you a case story. I had a woman who came to see me with a frozen neck. Been to the neurologist, been to chiropractors, been to osteopaths, been everywhere to deal with this pain in her neck. Eventually, she rolled in for some hypnosis, as I found over the years. Eventually, all roads lead to hypnosis one way or the other. So the woman sat in my office, and I said, okay, I assume that you want me to do some hypnosis for pain control. She said, yes, I would. But I should tell you first that in a past life, I was Mary Queen of Scots. So I said, okay, that's fine. And she stopped me. She said, aren't you going to tell me that I'm crazy? I said, no, why would I do that? I don't know whether you were Mary Queen of Scots in a past life. I don't know if I was anybody in a past life, but I'm certainly not going to say that you weren't Mary Queen of Scots if that's what you genuinely believe. An amazing metamorphosis occurred at that point, because the frozen neck ceased to be a problem. We did no hypnosis, not in the traditional sense. We did not discuss the pain. What she required was validation that what she had experienced or what she believes that she experiences is legitimate. That is what I'm talking about with regards to utilization. Don't argue with them. Take and use everything that they've got. Make client an ally as opposed to an adversary, and you'll find that your results are off. Will turn out to be an awful lot better. As a little sidebar on that, after this woman came to see me, now, I always said if I didn't do hypnosis, I would have loved to have been a historian. I'm very big on history. I went and read up on Mary's execution. Now, Mary was beheaded. Mary was beheaded by her cousin, Elizabeth I. But they did a botched job of it. It took three blows of the axe to eventually kill her. The first blow caught the top of her head and severed part of the top of the head. The second blow caught the shoulder and the neck, but didn't actually sever the head. The third blow is what eventually cut the head off. And when the axeman held the head up, the grabbed by the hair, I don't know if you've ever seen this in the old films, the head fell off the hair. She was wearing a wig. And the head rolled down off the scaffold. And people could hear the whimper of a dog. Well, Mary's little companion, her little puppy, was underneath the large dress that she was wearing at the time. So she followed her mistress up to the block, as it were. You'll probably notice that throughout this, I may tell you the odd story or two. Other than the fact I quite enjoy telling stories, it'll also fit in as I discuss metaphor towards the end of our little time together. But as I was saying, with regards to utilization, take and use everything. Your client cannot give you any information that is not going to help you. And sometimes what we need to do is we need to really listen to what our clients are telling us, because if you're smart, as I'm sure you all are, you will listen to your clients closely, because not only will your clients tell you what's wrong with them, they're going to tell you how to fix it, and they're going to tell you what they need to hear. If you listen appropriately, your clients will do all of the therapeutic work for you and make your jobs and your lives an awful lot easier. Okay, so any questions so far regarding utilization?
Sean, as an instructor, I see a lot of new hypnotherapists really get trapped into being more with trying to follow a process than being with their client. And that's what I see you saying, is that you need to really be with your client. You need to be very observant. You need to be a good listener, because in the story they tell you and the background they give you, when you bring that objective listener in, you're able to really pick up what the client needs. And then instead of swimming upstream, you're able to go with the flow and help them to where they want to get. Am I following you right there, Sean?
Absolutely, Cal. I know that you've taught your fair old amount of hypnotists and hypnotherapists as I have. One of the things I like about your five-path system is the fact that it's a nice systematic method of doing intervention work. However, it is not rigid. It is not, you use this script for that and that script for the other, and this script comes in here as well. I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I'm going to say it anyway, because as I say, we're amongst friends. As a general rule, I think that our practitioners worldwide rely far too much on scripts. As moderator of the National Guilds Forum, I see this question come up time and time again. I am working with a desk phobic. The only reason I can think of a desk phobic is I'm looking at my desk at the moment, but a desk phobic. Does anyone have a script as to how to deal with that? You don't need scripts an awful lot of the time. Scripts are great templates, and they give us some perspective as to what we do and how we do it. But we mustn't get so bogged down with, I'm going to use this script, that script, and the other script, and then I need to do this pattern and that pattern. Because by doing that, we have forgotten that we have a human being sitting in front of us who has probably already told us the hint of the story, the thing that's going to actually make them change or help them to make themselves change. We oftentimes can drop the ball on this, which is rather unfortunate, because one of the things I found over the years is asking the right questions. Now, this is obviously for another day, but within the motivational hypnotism model, there's a whole thing about questions. What drives a person's behavior? What makes a person choose to do the things that they want to do? That information, above practically all else, even more so than personal history, can often lead to the breakthrough a person needs. But if you don't ask, if you don't listen, you're never going to hear that. If you've got your head buried in a script, you're never going to pick that up, which is unfortunate because we see an awful lot, and I'm sure you've seen this yourself, Cal, there are an awful lot of good practitioners out there who are shackled to doing the X plus Y equals Z model rather than saying, let's fly by the seat of our pants. I know that I'm sure that many of you on this call have already found this out, depending on how long you've done this, that some of the best therapy, some of the best interventions are done when you've got no idea what you're going to do, which surprisingly enough leads me into a story. I'm going to talk to you about metaphor now. I was going to save metaphor for last, but I've now been rabbiting on about stories enough that I think I can probably start with it now. The idea of using story as a means of change work is nothing new. Stories are an integral part of our, well, of Western, Eastern, all civilization. We are all the accumulation of the stories that have been told. We are all the stories that we have gone past. And using stories for therapy is certainly not an uncommon dynamic. It's the easiest way to convey a message without actually coming down too hard on any one particular thing. So, we use the story in order to help the client to go from where he is or where she is now to where he or she wants to get to. Sometimes, let's take the person who has a fear of flying. Nice and simple one. Sometimes the notion of taking a person from fear of flying to getting them on the plane is too huge a leap to make in a single step. So all the direct suggestion in the world and all of the other bits and pieces, no matter how one phrases this, a person does not see the ability of getting from A to B. So a metaphor acts as a bridge, if you will, between where they are now and where they want to get to. And the metaphor itself helps the person to get to where they have to go in a way that they're unlikely to want to argue with, in a way they are unlikely to have anything unpleasant with, because we all love stories. You know, at the end of the day, we all have our favorites. For the first time, I mean, I'd studied Ericksonian work for years before I actually used it, because a lot of it I thought, well, you know, that's all great, well, and good, but it'll never work with my clients. And, of course, we all know that the moment you start thinking like that, you're absolutely right, it won't work with your clients. But I was working with a lorry driver, what you would call a trucker. And I tried everything with this guy. This guy had some severe confidence issues and some severe anxiety difficulties. And I did everything. I regressed. I did behavioral. I hit him with NLP. I basically did everything, beat him over the head with a golf club. And I don't know if you've ever done this yourselves, but I know I certainly have. When I'm lost and have no idea what to do next, I will ask my unconscious mind what to do. So whilst I'm doing the induction, I'm saying, dear unconscious mind, because I like to be nice. I have no idea what I'm going to do with this person, so when I open my mouth the next time, please let whatever comes out be the thing that's going to help this person to change. And I opened my mouth at the end of the induction, and it was, all of the animals in the forest love Cinderella. And I thought to myself, my unconscious mind has a sense of humor, and oftentimes is inappropriate with the sense of humor. So I started on with the story of Cinderella and went through the whole thing. And meanwhile, whilst I'm doing that, I'm saying to myself, well, what's going to happen here is one of three things. He is either going to come out of trance and he's going to yell at me, leave, and not pay. Second scenario is he's going to get up, hit me, leave, and not pay. And the third option was he was going to say nothing, leave, and not pay. So I'd pretty well written this session off because I had no idea why I was coming up with this cock and bull story about Cinderella. And after the session, he opened his eyes and he looked at me and said, you know, Sean, I've got it. Paid me and left. And I thought, well, got what? There was nothing there. Nothing of any significance, certainly. So I waited until the next week until he came back. Now, this guy was dressed when he first came to see me in a big leather jacket, tattoos all up his arm, you know, piercings. Well, certainly I could see piercings. I don't know if he had piercings where I couldn't see, but I wasn't all that interested in that. But he came back the next week, and I hardly recognized him. He had completely changed his mode of dress. He removed just about all of the studs and the like and out of his mouth and his face and such. And he said to me, you know, Sean, I thought about our last session, and it occurs to me, I never really wanted to do this for a living. I always wanted to do, you know, I was a nice guy, I am a nice guy, but to be a trucker or a lorry driver or whatever you're willing to call this person, it really, you have to be a bit mean, and you have to look a bit tough, and you have to do all these sorts of things that I don't really feel comfortable doing. So I'm going to give this up. He got the name and the number of places that could do the acid stuff for the tattoos to get those off of him. And he went back to college to become a gardener. And as far as I know, to this day, he is you know, a very successful gardener, happy as Larry, because he's not involved doing the stuff he doesn't want to do. Now, you might ask yourselves the question, as I did, why on earth would listening to Cinderella actually do that for a person? So, being a bit of a lazy sod, I went out and rented Cinderella rather than reading the book. The movies are always nicer and it's a bit easier and quicker. And I watched the movie completely and I realized, oh, now I get it. Cinderella is a great story about transformation. Cinderella even has the unconscious in it, for goodness sake. We've got a fairy godmother putting limitations on what you can do and how you can feel good. And in the end, what turned out to be the most important thing was not what the external was doing, but what the internal was doing. Which is a perfect example for this particular individual because he looked the part of what he was doing. Yet, what was on the inside was what was important and a bit that he didn't want to get away from, or the bit that he wanted to get more towards, rather than the external, which is something that he was not particularly happy with. So, basically, using metaphor, excuse me, relies on a few things. First of all, you use it to pace and lead a client through their experience. So basically use the story to take them through a set of scenarios. But let me back up for just a second. With regards to metaphor, there are two types of metaphor. There's surface structure metaphor and there's deep structure metaphor. Deep structure metaphor is an example like Cinderella, where the meaning of the story is not obvious within the story. You're just telling something that's abstract, and hopefully the client will get something out of it. A surface structure metaphor is more like, I had a guy who came in to see me the other week with more or less the same problem you have had, and this is what he did. In other words, it's fairly obvious from the message what's actually going to happen. Now, once we go through that, we patiently lead the client through their experience, through the story. What I tend to do, because I like to dissociate a client, if it's a male client, it's a female in the story. If it's a female, it's a male in the story, unless it's a gender-specific issue. You don't want to have a story about a guy suffering with PMT, so it wouldn't be appropriate. But in the main, we change genders. We pace and lead them through the story. In the story, we give them resources that they've already got. Things like a fairy godmother or a leprechaun or something that's going to give them insight and stuff within so that they can get through the problem they've got. And then a successful resolution. By the way, make the resolution successful. People are miserable and depressed enough without you telling people, Oh, and by the way, the end of the story, the hero gets killed, the wife's family gets burned to the ground, the homestead gets taken, the family dog falls off of a tree and dies. This is not the way to end a hypnotic story. You want to end it on a positive, uplifting note so that the client walks away with the feeling that there was a resolution at the end. Because after all, the way the unconscious mind works is it requires closure, which is why the cliffhanger, if you, those of you who remember back to things like Dallas and such, why Dallas ended each series with a major episode that you needed to know the answer to, was a way of exciting the unconscious mind to try to figure out what actually happened and to derive and to make it so that you need the finality, the closure. So we close our stories within our therapy in order to assist people to get that warm, fuzzy feeling at the end that they got resolution. And the other bit about metaphors, which is quite useful, is the fact that, well, basically you're telling a story. This is not about me, even though, of course, that's exactly who it is about. But generally speaking, we listen to stories pretty well uncritically. If somebody comes up to us at a conference and gives us a real cock and bull story, chances are we're still going to listen to it. We're not going to say, look, pal, you're full of garbage. It's not actually the way it is. So we are more likely to less critically listen to metaphor than we might be to you will do this and you won't do that within regards to sort of direct suggestion work. So that's the basics around metaphor. I want to cover before I finish with you tonight the basics of language patterns. For those of you who are fans of NLP, you will know that there is a two-volume book called Patterns 1 and Patterns 2 of Ericksonian Language Patterns, which are fascinating books and very long-winded and very, very confusing. See, the whole point of NLP was originally to decodify and make things simple. The reality is, to make things simple doesn't pay the bills. So what ends up happening is you make things simple, then make them complicated. John Grinder, who was one of the co-founders of NLP, was a master linguist. He's a professor at the University of Southern California in linguistics. The Milton model, as it's known as in the NLP world, but basically Ericksonian language patterns, were codified with something called general semantic tags. So an obscure branch of linguistics, they're going to use those phraseologies and those tags so that you can understand them, which basically means so you can't understand them. The basic tenet of Ericksonian language patterns is to create ambiguity. And by creating ambiguity, you end up avoiding conscious intervention. So if I were to say to you, I know what you're all thinking. The first thing you have to do pretty well is to say, well, how does he know? Actually, now that he mentions it, what am I thinking? And meanwhile, whilst you're having this internal dialogue, I have already slipped in some suggestions because you're not going to critically listen to it. The idea of the language pattern within Ericksonian work is to create a space where the conscious mind is distracted enough so that the unconscious mind becomes open and receptive to suggestion. It really is as simple as that. The NLP crowd have found somewhere in the region of 19 language patterns, ranging from what I've just done, a mind read, to what's called a selectional restriction violation, which is where we say that only it's a malformed statement in that only humans and animals have feelings. So in other words, you can say that a chair feels comfortable. Now, can a chair feel comfortable? Because a chair has no feelings, it's an inanimate object. And whilst you're thinking about whether a chair actually does feel comfortable or whether it's us feeling comfortable in the chair, again, more suggestions can be laid in. I really haven't done language patterns a huge amount of justice, but there's an awful lot of that that needs to be covered, and there's an awful lot of it that is a load of old nonsense. I tell my students, the only thing I'm interested in is can you use them? Rather than can you label them, can you tell me what it is, can you tell me what a complex equivalent is, etc. Those aren't important. What's important is that you utilize language that is going to make your clients or help your clients to utilize their unconscious rather than giving you conscious answers. That's pretty well the whole point of the language pattern within Ericksonian hypnosis. So, again, I've gas bagged on about the last two things on my list. if you have any questions, I'm ready to hear them.
Well, I can't speak for everybody in the room here, but I can tell you that Adam, our tech guy, he's getting pretty excited about Ericksonian hypnosis. He says, very interesting. I invite anyone in the room to please ask Sean any questions that you might have.
I'm encouraged by what I hear, and particularly the scripts, because I think what's happened in the past is that that the scripts provide confidence for the novice and the hypnotist that is just starting out. And I think that was probably the case years gone by as well. But I think these days our profession has changed and matured, and guys like Sean and you, Cal, offer much more to take us to the next stage. And things like these professional Meet the Pro seminars, the email groups, allow us to move on to the next stage and grab the confidence to put the scripts to the side and just use them as a reference piece.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. I'll tell you what I'm hearing Sean say is he's really promoting something that every hypnotherapist can add to whatever style of hypnosis they use. You can take the script no test, or you can take the five-pather, or someone who is more of an NLP, or anyone, and begin to learn these kind of really communication strategies and begin to be better at whatever you do. And, of course, as the NLP people have done, they have taken these kinds of techniques and used them to make salespeople better salespeople, to make counselors better counselors, to make teachers better teachers, speakers better speakers. So really, it's an enhanced form of communication and perhaps persuasion. Have I got the, am I coming close there, Sean?
Absolutely, Cal. It's something that I think Erickson, I think, would have probably gotten on in the long run with the National Guild. I mention this because the National Guild, in all of our publications, we talk about providing a free and open forum for the discussion and learning of hypnotism. Basically, you can use anything in order to help your clients to actualize. The only thing that I am against in the great scheme of things is limitation. And, you know, ultimately we try and help our clients to work through all their limitations. I try and help hypnotherapists and hypnotists to work through their limitations with this sort of stuff as well. But basically you can use everything that you've ever learned and then continue to develop from that perspective. And there are tremendously good people out there. I mean, if one looks at it from the perspective of even 10 years ago, certainly 17 years ago when I got started, there wasn't a lot of talent out there as far as instructors and such. We are so very fortunate nowadays to have really top-rated, top-notch instructors in both the medical, psychological, and professional worlds of hypnotism out there to learn from. And I suppose the only advice I would give to folk is to continue to go out there and learn from as many people as you can do, but don't limit yourself to just following a particular brand of therapy just for the sake of it.
Beautiful. We've still got a few more minutes, but before we run out of time, I want to introduce a couple of things to those who are in the room and those who will be listening to this in recorded form. I want to thank Sean for contributing to the e-zine on the www.banyanhypnosismall. He's writing a continuing column on Ericksonian hypnosis, and the first installment for that column has been written and is there. I'd also like to mention that in addition to that, he's got a couple of books that we list on the mall. One is Building a Successful and Ethical Hypnotherapy Practice, and you can sure feel free to check that out on the mall. And then Sean was also mentioned Motivational Hypnotism, And so please feel free to check that out and learn about his integrative approach. And what I get from Sean is that the only thing that really matters is that you continue to grow as a hypnotherapist and you continue to get results and more results. And that's why he has this non-restrictive, eclectic approach. Good. All right. Please, any more questions or comments for Sean?
Sean, when Cal mentioned things about non-teachers using NLP and things like that, how would Ericksonian hypnosis be utilized in a classroom? How would NLP be utilized in a classroom? Things like that. I was thinking of doing a teaching thing, and I was wondering how I could apply things that I've been kind of soaking up from Cal, because I've been working with him for a little while, and the things that you've been talking about for a little while here. I'm just wondering the best way to apply those to a teaching sort of backdrop.
Well, and there are quite a few bits and pieces to this that you can actually incorporate. Certainly, using things like language patterns in education is fairly common. That's most great communicators will tend to use that. Things like representational systems to pick out learning styles. Are people visual learners, auditory learners, or kinesthetic learners? What I'll do for you, Adam, if you like, and if you'll remind me, I've got some paperwork on this on my other computer. When I get back from Vegas, I'll send you through a file that will give you some basic ideas as to what to do. The last bit of this I'd say is certainly metaphors are useful for helping out with the educational process because, as I say, kids and adults both love to learn from stories, so that's always beneficial.
All right, Sean, and we're probably going to have to wrap this up in the next 4 or 5 minutes. So I'd like you to kind of wrap it up, and while you're at it, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you got cooking at the Solid Gold Weekend, and if you have classes they can go to at the NGH convention this year in August, or any upcoming classes you might have at your school. I'm sure that this is going to generate some interest and some people wanting to learn more from you. What can you tell us, Sean?
Well, thanks for that, Cal. I will be teaching at Solid Gold this year. I'll be teaching how to turbocharge your private practice. As I say, I've been doing this now for 17 years as my sole means of income. I think I've pretty well got it straight as to how one actually does this. Unlike an awful lot of folk when it comes to teaching practice building skills, I tell you all the mistakes I made as well, which is something that some folk don't like to actually do, but I find that it's actually more amusing to learn how I've messed up than it is to learn how I've actually got things right. So I'll be teaching that at Solid Gold this year. I'll be doing my stress management certification pre-conference this year, and I'll be doing our motivational hypnotism certification post-conference this year with Fiona Biddle, my co-author in the motivational hypnotism book. I'll be teaching my 2 hour on Erickson again at conference, plus I'll be doing a 1 hour on smoking cessation. That's pretty well all that's going on from that perspective. I mean, we run continuing professional development courses at the Academy, which we can use for distance learning and such, which if you're interested in finding out a bit more about that, you can go to ukacademy.org. And you can look up and take a perspective and do that sort of thing. We're more than happy for you to have a look at such things like that. The only other thing I've got cooking at the moment is I've got a date tomorrow night, Cal, which is, you know, when you're married, it's not always easy to get a date these days, with a very attractive American University student who I believe you might know. I'll be having dinner with her tomorrow night, so I'll make sure that I get a decent amount of beauty sleep for tonight.
Well, congratulations. I'm sure you will be the envy of everyone in the restaurant when they see you with that lovely young lady who is, of course, also my daughter. So all you folks out there listening to this, you have an idea of the degree of trust and friendship I feel for this fellow here. Sean, that's going to be about it for now. We've got to wrap things up. for the next seminar. But thank you so much for coming in and to our little virtual classroom and sharing your wit and wisdom with the group. And I'll probably leave this room open for maybe just a couple more minutes if you have anything else you want to wrap up for. And if anyone else has any questions that they didn't get on yet. So the official ending is right now. Thank you all very much for coming to the Meet the Pros audio seminar program, this time with Sean Brookhouse. Thank you very much, Sean. Good night, everybody.